Welcome to the SNC Shop Talk podcast. I'm your host, Dorian Grenier, and this is episode number 8. Today, we're going to talk about pain, placebo effects, and some of the evidence behind some form of treatments and interventions, and hopefully much more. I'm super excited to have Dr. Felicity Braithwaite on the show today. She's a registered physiotherapist with expertise in musculoskeletal physiotherapy, an associate lecturer at Flinders University in Adelaide, Australia, and has recently earned her PhD at the University of South Australia, which we're going to talk a little bit later in the show. She's also part of Professor Lorimer Moseley's team at Body and Mind, tackling a variety of questions surrounding pain from multiple angles and producing some very high quality content. Welcome to the show, Felicity.
Thank you very much.
All right. So I hope I got most of those things right. But for some of the listeners that don't know you, give us a quick little background on yourself and how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, okay. So I actually graduated as a physiotherapist in 2014. So I haven't been in the game all that long, actually. When I graduated, at that point, I decided that I was more interested in research than clinical work. I think just the scalability of research was really attractive to me, the potential to improve human welfare at a societal level. Really drew me towards research. So I went straight into a PhD after I graduated. And I was very fortunate to be able to do that with the Body and Mind group and Professor Lorimer Moseley. The immense privilege to work with him and his group is certainly not lost on me. And yeah, so to give you a little background about my actual PhD research, it was all about how to make shams for physical treatments more credible. So what I mean by physical treatments is those interactive therapist-administered types of treatments that often involve the laying on of hands and things like that. So typically it's very difficult to create shams for these sorts of treatments because we have to convince the patients and ideally the therapists as well that they've experienced a real physical treatment with all the sensations and rituals surrounding that when they actually haven't. So, and because this is so difficult, a lot of researchers have actually written it off as being too hard, even impossible. So yeah, so it's like a lot of researchers have actually given up on their trying, which is really unfortunate because it means we don't have robust efficacy trials for many of the treatments that are commonly used in physiotherapy and other allied health professions as well. And essentially what this means is we don't actually know if these treatments work beyond placebo effects. And unfortunately, this situation has been the basis for low standards in the evidence base and acceptance of a lot of unproven treatments in clinical practice. What I actually did in my PhD was create a process to develop more credible shams for physical treatments. I was actually really shocked when I started that there is no guideline for making a sham out there at all. There's no guidance, nothing. for such an important thing, you know, it was shocking to me. So I set out to do that in my PhD. And so I prospectively planned 4 stages to develop a sham. And we used dry needling as sort of the vehicle to test that process. So the 4 stages were systematic review to see what previous sham controlled trials of dry needling had done, and how they blinded people. A Delphi survey, which is a survey of experts. And then we did a practical workshop with a few invited experts, a few participants to test the ideas from the first 2 stages. And then we tested it in a fully blown randomized experiment at the end. And we actually managed to successfully blind both patients and therapists in that trial, which therapist blinding and dry needling has never even been attempted, let alone successful before. So it was a very, successful process, which was great for me.
That's awesome. Yeah. So you broke up there just a second ago, so I didn't catch all of it, but I'm just going to go ahead and move along. No, it's all good. I caught the last part. So maybe just backtrack a little bit and cover like, what is placebo? Because I believe, especially in the health community, or maybe more so with the general public, there are a lot of misconceptions around that concept of placebo, nocebo. What is it? And what is it not?
Yeah. Placebo has almost been a bit of a dirty word, hasn't it? In the research community, but it's becoming more and more accepted as a legitimate effect. Research is showing these days that placebo effects are real, genuine neurobiological, psychological effects. But basically, to sort of define it, placebo effects are beneficial therapeutic effects that come about due to the context of a treatment and not due to the treatment itself. So even if a treatment has no active ingredients, like a placebo treatment, a sugar pill or something like that, people still have positive outcomes, which I find really, really fascinating. And I obviously did a lot of research around that in my PhD, and I hope to in the future as well. So this is why we see in trials, often people in placebo groups will have a positive response to the supposedly inert treatment. And this is exactly why we need placebo-controlled trials, because we need to be able to separate those placebo effects from real specific effects of treatments. Otherwise, we don't know if they're truly effective.
Right, right. So you've already talked a little bit about it, but with the intervention that you guys did, how exactly were you able to fool participants and the practitioners? Because when it just comes to giving people a placebo, most people would think of, oh, here's a sugar pill, but with an actual manual intervention, how is that even possible?
Yeah. So that was the million-dollar question of my PhD, actually. So to sort of give you an idea behind my thinking, because when I first started out, I didn't know either. This question, it almost seems impossible. and many have claimed that it is impossible. And so I kind of tried to approach it from a really new angle. And part of that was getting input from experts. So we had expert input at a couple of the stages in the process. And we had expert input from research methodologists, dry needlers, and also experts in deception and hypnosis. So part of that group actually involved magicians. And the reason we included them was because magicians trade in deception, so they're really well placed to help us with this really complex problem of deceiving people into believing they've had a real physical treatment. And they use cognitive and sensory illusions all the time to make audience believe they've just seen something that violates the law of nature right in front of their very eyes. And they understand that these cognitive and perceptual processes are hackable, and they actually use our evolutionary shortcomings against us just to fool us. So we thought they'd provide some pretty unique and hopefully helpful input, and they did. So one of my favorite strategies that was suggested by a magician was to fool the therapists. We actually recruited some fake patients and we got them to report the opposite sensations and feign the opposite sensations of the treatment they were actually allocated. So people in the sham group, when they were getting sham dry needling, they were pretending that it was quite painful and all of that, and vice versa.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Wow. Very cool.
So yeah, essentially. Sorry.
No, no. So what did the actual intervention look like then, and how were you able to, I guess, fake a needle?
Yeah, so we actually ended up inventing a device for the study, and basically, I don't know how familiar you are with dry needles, but when they come in the packaging, they actually have like a plastic guide tube that comes with them. So we actually put a base on the guide tube, an adhesive base, and we covered the guide tube with some material to make it so you couldn't see through it anymore, to make it non-transparent. And
gotcha.
Yeah. So basically, we did this for both the active and sham group. So the therapist couldn't see whether the needle was piercing the skin or not, and neither could the patient. And yeah, that the interesting part though was that the sham needles, we cut them off so that they didn't even touch the participant's skin. And so we didn't even try to mimic the tactile sensation of dry needling at all with our sham. But we still managed to blind them because of all the cognitive and other multisensory cues that we gave them. So things like verbal suggestions, manipulating their expectations before they even came into the study. We told them things like most people, when they get real dry needling, don't feel anything. So if you don't feel anything, that's completely normal. And then obviously people in the sham group, when they didn't feel anything, they didn't automatically assume that they got the sham. And we use other techniques as well, like distraction. And yeah, there was a lot of different aspects of the protocol that were sort of beyond the treatment itself to convince them that it was a real treatment going on. Yeah.
That's sweet. So in the end, as far as the outcome goes, it was a success.
Yeah. So basically our outcome was we just asked the participants and the therapists whether they thought they had experienced a real or sham treatment. And so our primary outcome was whether correct guesses were any better than chance or random guessing. And so for the patient group, I think it was 48.9% correct. So that was perfect. And the therapists were even worse. They were only 40.2% correct.
Wow. Okay. So that really goes to show, hey?
Yeah. It definitely worked in that particular trial. I mean, it was done with healthy participants and had a few other limitations. So it needs to be tested on clinical populations and things. That's sort of the next step. But yeah, it's very exciting.
That's awesome. Well, I think placebos or understanding the effect of some call it non-specific effects is crucial to actually getting a little bit further ahead when it comes to conducting proper science, especially in our field. So real quick, are some placebos more effective than others? For example, like a sugar pill versus a sham acupuncture or sham surgery, even that we see sometimes in certain studies.
Yeah, sham surgery, one of my favorite shams, quite extreme. But it just, right. I think that just goes to show how important the placebo-controlled study is to test effects, that those kind of shams exist, you know. They're super important. And actually, a lot of the sham surgery trials for pain have shown real surgeries haven't outperformed sham. So that's really important information for patients to have. But yeah, getting back to your question, definitely some placebos are certainly more effective than others. There have even been a few studies that have directly compared, for example, placebo pills with sham acupuncture or other devices. And the devices nearly always come out on top. And it's believed that this is because these treatments are surrounded by highly credible perceptual and contextual cues. So things like therapeutic rituals, the use of serious looking medical devices, the perception that the treatment is expensive, all these kind of things interact with patient expectations of benefit, so positive expectations that this treatment is really going to work for them and their problem, which promotes a larger placebo response. So expectancy of benefit is the best predictor that we have of placebo response. I think another thing with these physical device-based treatments is that they're therapist-administered, unlike a pill, which you just sort of swallow yourself. And so that gives the therapist an opportunity to be enthusiastic with the delivery and give lots of suggestions about likely benefits. And the added element of touch as well between the patient and the therapist, that all this stuff is super conducive to a placebo response. So I think that is why we do see in experimental studies these device-based treatments and physical treatments do outperform things like pills. Yeah.
Wow. That's really interesting. So I guess the next question then would be, if you do have a patient that has some very strong beliefs around a certain treatment modality, but you as a practitioner, if you're aware of the literature, you know that they're like that this is not the the best treatment option at this point in time, how do you go about breaking down those barriers in belief?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think in my clinical practice, I always ask my patient, I'll recommend a management plan or a treatment or something, and I'll always ask them how much they expect it to work for them, because I think that's really important information for us to gather, because we want to make sure that our expectation and goals are in line with theirs to maximize the chance of them adhering to the treatment, number one, and also maximize the benefit too. But I think it's a problem that we come across a lot in physiotherapy. We get people coming in all the time wanting some sort of passive, quick fix, sort of manual therapy based treatment. And they want that because they believe it's going to work. And if they believe it's going to work, then sure, yeah, that could predict a bigger response or a bigger outcome. But I don't think we should just sort of give into that. I think we should really talk to our patients about what we think is important, what we think is truly going to help them in the long run, and to try and sort of shift their expectations towards more beneficial treatments for them. Yeah.
Gotcha. So is there, I recently watched a video of Dr. Harriet Hall, I believe it was, and she said something really interesting, which was the potential negative outcomes or potential negative outcomes when it comes to administering an intervention that is only working off a placebo, but objectively doesn't get the patient better. I believe that was with asthma patients. So if that's the case and they actually feel better, so regardless of, you know, the kind of pill they received or the kind of medicine they got, but objectively, when you're actually measuring the condition of the patients, they did not, or they only got better on the real medication. So are there potential negative outcomes when it comes to therapeutic interventions if you do not prescribe to the highest quality of care right away?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's a really good point that you raise, particularly when we talk about treatments out there that are not proven beyond placebo effects. You know, if the treatment is in fact all placebo, placebos rarely cure. They don't really act on the pathophysiology of disease beyond their symptomatic manifestations. So they mainly address the subjective and self-appraised symptoms of the patient. So, for example, yeah, your asthma example is a good example there. Same thing. There's no evidence that placebos can shrink a tumor, but what they can do is help with other side effects. So things like that come with cancer or its treatment, like fatigue, nausea, pain. So, yeah, I think this is where it becomes really important to properly test treatments to ensure that they do indeed have specific effects on pathophysiology. But I think it's interesting to consider this question in the context of pain as well, which is by its nature subjective. So,
right.
Yeah. So by, you know, the context of chronic pain in particular, feeling better, you know, is being better. But, you know, I think where it becomes important for people like us working with people maybe in an acute injury, we do have to be careful and specific with our recommendations to patients, because it is possible that the perception of symptoms will disappear before the tissues have fully healed. So, you know, particularly if we do our job really well and really reduce the threat value of that injury, it is more than possible that that pain will disappear before the tissues are fully healed. So just being mindful of that in our patients.
So as far as treatment goes with people in pain, since obviously, you know, subjective information to the patient, like, hey, I feel better whenever I get a massage, or I feel better when, you know, I get adjusted, or all this sort of stuff. Is there an effect where they, like, people can start to associate a certain form of treatment and actually strengthen a placebo?
Yeah. So I think I think so, yeah. So like a conditioned placebo response. Is that what you're talking about?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like Pavlov's dog. Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. No, totally. There's actually a lot of placebo studies out there that have shown that conditioning is a mechanism of placebo. So people do associate certain treatments with positive outcomes, and then they go back and that happens again and again and again. Whether it potentiates, I'm not sure. It doesn't seem so anecdotally. I see a lot of people going for chiropractic adjustments every 6 weeks, and they believe that they need to keep going back, and that just astounds me. If you have to keep going back, it's not working. You know?
Right.
But
that's just a logical fallacy. I never got that one, but
yeah.
Yeah, I hear you.
Yeah, yeah. But yes, definitely. And I think that's why we do see positive effects in placebo groups in trials, is that not just the treatment, but you know, the context of treatment, so the healthcare setting, being with a healthcare professional, all these cues we associate with positive outcomes and we feel better.
Right. Now, one of the interesting facts about placebo analgesia seems to be it's relatively short-lived, whereas nocebo hyperalgesia appears to be a little bit more resistant to extinction and often persists. What are your thoughts around that when it comes to placebo versus nocebic effects?
Well, based on what I've read, the study of nocebo effects isn't as advanced as placebo effects. So yeah, like okay. There's a lot we still don't know about that, but it is really interesting, and it's a hard thing to study because you can't get that through ethics, really, giving people negative effects on purpose.
Right.
So that's why it's harder to study, but essentially they're based on negative expectations, right? So usually what will happen is in a trial situation, people in placebo groups will be given the same information as people in the active group, and that includes potential side effects. And even just that verbal suggestion of a potential side effect can lead to the perception of that side effect, and people reporting
wow.
it. And yeah, it's even been estimated, I think it was about up to 26% of patients in placebo groups withdraw from trials due to perceived adverse effects, which is just fascinating, because obviously there's
wow.
there's no active ingredient in the placebo that would cause that, right? So so there's something else going on there, whether it is anticipation of negative effects due to verbal suggestions and negative expectancy, or maybe like a heightened attention to normal background discomforts of everyday life in the context of a new treatment regime. But yeah, whether they last longer than a normal side effect, I'm not sure.
Okay. No, this is like I think that's super interesting, just because it kind of shows the importance of, you know, a verbal verbal instructions in relation to the effectiveness of a treatment. Or well, I'm almost thinking like a couple steps past the rehab stage, once you look at just the effectiveness of an exercise, like how you kind of quote unquote selling that to the client, right?
Yeah, exactly. So creating positive expectancy as well, and getting that buy-in from the client, for sure. And yeah, I think that's a really important part of our clinical practice, is to maximize those positive expectancies, because that will maximize placebo effects. And placebo effects it's not a dirty word. It's not a negative thing, because it can be additive to real effects, real specific effects of the treatment. So I actually think that's a really important part of our job, is to create a placebo enhancing environment to get the most out of our treatments. And we can do that through verbal suggestions.
Gotcha. Are there some other things that you'd like to go back to when it comes to maximizing those non-specific effects in your clinical practice? I don't know. There's different, obviously, techniques. One, it's probably quality information, practicing empathic listening, explaining why you're doing is the best and most effective thing to do at this point in time. Like, to me, that kind of sounds a lot like really good coaching.
Yeah, no, yeah, totally. You're totally right. I think those things are super important. Talking about the likely benefits, obviously not exaggerating beyond what the data tells us, but talking about it in a positive, enthusiastic way, framing the statistics in a positive way. There's some really interesting data talking about how you frame the statistics to a patient can actually have an effect. So, for example, saying you have an 80% chance of getting better with this treatment is better than saying you have a 20% chance of not getting better, things like that. Just little tricks. Yeah. I think using real world clinical examples is really powerful as well. So talking about other patients or clients that you have that you've helped who have been in a similar situation, I think patients really respond to that. I think also a really important thing is that you as the coach or the therapist really need to believe in what you're saying too and be confident about what you're doing. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you need to have a really solid understanding of why and how this management strategy works and a really solid understanding of the research behind it and the theoretical justifications, because patients pick up on so many things, you know, verbal and non-verbal. Actually, one of my favorite studies, basically what they did was they had patients who had just had a dental procedure. I think it was like a molar extraction or something like that. And they told all the patients the same information, which was that they, after the procedure, they would get fentanyl, which is a really strong analgesic drug, placebo injection, which was just saline, or naloxone, which is a opioid antagonist. So essentially that would increase their pain. So they were told that they would get one of three injections. One would reduce their pain, one would do nothing, and one would increase their pain. But what was really interesting about this study was that they had two groups of clinicians. So one group of clinician was told the exact same information as the patients, that there was one of, they would get one of three injections, but they wouldn't know which. But the other group was quite cheekily told that there was a fentanyl shortage. And so there was going to be no fentanyl in that patient group, just naloxone or the saline injection. But they were strictly told not to tell the patients anything, just go about the study as normal. But in actual fact, all the patients were given the placebo, so the saline injection, but neither the patients or clinicians knew that. And when they actually looked at the pain outcomes afterwards, it's quite astounding. So the only difference between the groups was the information that the clinicians were given, but there was a statistical and clinically significant difference between the two groups. In fact, if you look up the study, the graph is quite astounding. There is a huge difference between the two groups, and I just find that quite incredible because the clinicians were actually audited and they were watched. So they didn't say anything to the patients. So the patients picked up on these subtle behavioral cues that the therapists were giving off. You know, it could have been a brighter smile. It could have been a bit more confidence, a lower tone of voice. Who knows? But the patients were picking up on it and it was influencing their outcomes. So I think that study, you know, made me really aware of how important our behavior is as clinicians and how it rubs off on patients and how it can really affect their outcomes. So it's not just the verbal suggestions, it's all the cues that we give off and how much we believe in what we're doing.
Now, to me, that's incredibly powerful. I'm just thinking out loud, but have there been experiments done where, let's say, a proven intervention or whatever medicine was given to somebody in pain, but the therapist was attaching a nocebic value and thus got a negative outcome, even though the medicine was supposedly working? So in other words, patient A, you know, is in pain and they've been given a painkiller, but the doctor or therapist or whoever says this is going to make your pain worse. So can you cancel out those, like, can you cancel out a real effect with a placebo effect?
I'm not aware of any studies that have done that. I think probably just with difficulties of getting it through ethics.
fair enough.
Yeah. But it would be very interesting. Okay. I think there's some quite innovative designs out there. Like there's one called a balanced placebo design, where There's sort of four groups. One group gets the real treatment and is told they're getting the real treatment. Another group gets placebo and is told they're getting placebo. And then the third group gets placebo but is told they're getting active treatment. And then the fourth group, you know, gets the active treatment but is told placebo. And you can really measure the effect of different expectancies using that sort of design. But actually inducing a nocebo effect, to my knowledge, hasn't been done much because, yeah, just difficulties getting that through ethics, given that we know it can actually result in problems for people.
Yeah, fair enough, fair enough. Okay, yeah, no, I get that. Now, I personally like to believe most people working in the health and fitness industry are genuinely good people and want to help others. In your opinion, what are some of the reasons why we still see so much "quote unquote" quackery when it comes to treating people in pain?
I think one of the reasons it's still out there so much is because it does work. It's just how it's worked. They're not being completely honest about. And I think. With a lot of that quackery and pseudoscience and alternative therapies out there, they're delivered in a really placebo-enhancing way. So, you know, often the alternative therapists will spend hours with their patients listening to their stories, and they're really good at marketing themselves too. They're really good at spruiking their treatments and creating those positive expectancies and those treatments as well. They have a really mystical, magical, almost supernatural theoretical justification behind them too. And people want to believe that. They want to believe, wow, this treatment's going to magically cure me. And so they are effective, but I, you know, obviously I think that that's not good enough and that we need to be testing treatments to make sure that they do have specific effects, and you know we can still enhance those effects with placebo and non-specific effects. But I don't think relying on placebo effects alone is enough, and it's not ethical either, particularly when the treatments do involve risk, which a lot of them do.
Gotcha. Now, I was always curious about where regression to the mean kind of fits in with the whole placebo conversation, because, you know, one could argue if you give a condition enough time, at some point, if they're really bad, because most people tend to seek out healthcare when they're feeling their worst, it will inevitably get better. How do you go about that in the scientific setting to kind of tease those things out?
Yeah. So, it is a problem. And like, it's the same thing in clinical trials as well. People will often volunteer for trials when their symptoms are at their worst. So there's that risk of this, you know, natural symptom fluctuation. It's just going down naturally and, looking like a positive effect due to the treatment when it's actually not due to the treatment at all. So that's essentially why we have control groups. Placebo control groups do account for that. But you can't disentangle the regression to the mean effect from the placebo effect. If you just compare an active group with a placebo group, you need a no treatment control group as well. So a group that gets randomized to get nothing, and then you can actually measure that effect.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Now, there was a recent study I read. I don't have the reference on me. I can go back and put that into the show notes, but it essentially suggested that a therapist can pretty much make up whatever they want as long as they're friendly, positive with the client, you know, so they'll get some effect, at least in the short term. To me, as an S&C coach, that's kind of the equivalent of having somebody that doesn't really know much about anatomy, scientific principles, strength training, periodization, all those things, but is just a great guy or a gal to be around and has talent to kind of instantly connect with people that they work with. Is there something as far as, you know, educating healthcare practitioners that could be beneficial in getting those kind of soft skills to deliver more high quality treatments and maximize those non-specific effects?
Yeah, I think you've touched on something really important there. I think therapeutic alliance is one of the most important things we do as clinicians, not just to enhance non-specific effects, but to get people to engage with our treatments. And it is a challenging thing to teach, I think. I think it probably comes better with experience. But yeah, I think like some of the things we were talking about before are really important. I think just having that true belief in what you're doing, and true deep understanding in what you're recommending. So, you know, the mechanisms by which it works, the theoretical justifications and the research data that supports it. And if you can convey those things in a positive, enthusiastic way, and also, you know, just be a warm person, non-judgmental, open to listening to someone's story, active listening, all those sorts of things are the things we need to do to have that really open, honest, frank conversation about someone's really personal pain experience.
Right, right. Okay. Yeah, no, I love that. So the billion, like, if we look at the sports performance industries, there's a $1 billion industry within that that's all about supplements. And when you look a little closer, which unfortunately not a lot of people are, you find out real quick once you dig into some of the research that there's maybe not even a handful of things that are worth taking that actually show positive effects, but because it's such a huge market, it's still stuff that's being pushed onto people, right? There must be a big placebo component within kind of supplements or taking things to kind of enhance performance, even though they're not necessarily shown to work objectively.
Oh, for sure. There's so many things out there like that. I mean, look at homeopathy. I mean, by its own admission, it has no active ingredients, but people still do it and engage with it because they do, they'll engage with the treatment and they will have positive effects. And that's just, you know, a logical fallacy that you know, it's because they've done something, they've done a treatment, their symptoms have got better because of that treatment, when it could be because of a whole range of other reasons. And yeah, I'm sure the supplement industry the same. It's marketed really well, and, you know, people just believe that they need it to function. So, yeah.
Mm. Is there a place for utilizing some of those things where even though you know they're not per se working other than the placebo effect, but you're still kind of choosing to use those modalities to enhance what you're doing already? Or is it unethical to do that, knowing that there's nothing other than the placebo working?
My view is that that is unethical. I think that we have a duty to only provide treatments that we know have specific effects. I think it's fine to use non-specific effects to our advantage in those situations where we do know a treatment has specific effects and is going to, you know, alter our pathophysiology. But knowingly prescribing treatments that don't have a specific effect or that even are unproven, in my view, is unethical, particularly in the situation where, like I said before, where there is risk. So things like acupuncture, where you're puncturing the skin, there's a huge amount of risk associated with that. And, you know, we haven't proven acupuncture beyond placebo. So yeah, I don't think that's okay.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, I wholeheartedly agree there. So just real quick, jumping back to a little bit of the science aspect of it, I'm really curious your point of view. Is there, you obviously went over some of the difficulties when conducting kind of sham procedures versus real ones. What are the next steps that we need to take in the scientific community when it comes to studying different interventions and properly accounting for placebo and nocebo?
Well, obviously, I think that the main problem we're facing at the moment is that we don't have good placebos for a lot of our treatments, particularly those interactive therapist-administered treatments. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we face is that developing placebos for these sorts of treatments creates a really tricky paradox. So the more that you try to simulate one of these treatments, say a physical treatment like massage, the less likely the placebo will be inert or devoid of the theorized active ingredients of the massage treatment. So, for example, if you make a placebo for massage that still involves applying pressure to the person's body, someone would argue that that is part of the therapeutic mechanism of massage and invalidates the placebo. So then in that situation, if the trial is negative, they'll disregard the result because they'll say, well, the placebo was active, so no wonder there's no difference between the groups. But on the other hand, if the placebo is perceived to not be credible, so say like the massage, the sham for massage is like light touch or something on a different part of the body, the results of positive trials might be disregarded because people will read that and think, well, the people in the sham group will know they're getting sham, so they're not going to have a placebo effect, you know? So, yeah, I think we need to do better there, and we also need to focus on figuring out new ways, creative ways of blinding therapists, because over the last 20 years, attempts to blind therapists in physical treatment research have actually reduced. People are giving up. And like I was saying before with that dentist study with the injections, obviously therapists have a real effect on patient outcomes and they do need to be blinded. So I think the next steps are to develop better shams for our physical treatments and other interactive treatments as well, hopefully using my sham development process, but, you know, whichever way would be fine as long as we do it, because it needs, I think that's what we need to do, because at the moment I actually do feel for clinicians because the research on all these sorts of treatments is so unclear and it has so much potential for bias that we just don't know how these treatments work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it looks like a huge challenge. I mean, you know, just looking at some of the, just like you put it, how do you blind one, the practitioner? Because I believe there is something with if that person administering the treatment has a huge belief behind what they're doing, like that's inherently going to have an effect on, you know, whoever's receiving it. I mean, that's a big challenge. Yeah, I see that. I can see where you come from.
And yeah, and if you have therapists in sham groups who know they're delivering a sham, they're going to give off so many behavioral and nonverbal cues to sort of hint at that patient that this, you know, this is a dodgy treatment. This isn't going to work, you know, even if they don't mean to.
Right, right. It almost happens on a subconscious level. Yeah. Well, this is awesome. So is there anything that you look forward to in the next couple of years when it comes to doing research? Are you looking at other areas, like other than dry needling at the moment? Or I guess what are sort of the next steps in the foreseeable future for you?
Yeah, good question. I've been thinking about that question a lot lately because I only just finished my PhD. So the world is my oyster, I guess. So, yeah, I think I really do want to stay in the field of placebo and placebo effects. I'm really interested in looking at the mechanisms of placebo, moving on a bit from blinding, I think, and looking at the real mechanisms behind placebo analgesia and what actually predicts placebo response. We know that expectancy is a big one, but it still doesn't predict all of the variants. So I'm really interested in looking at that because I think one thing we do know is some people respond to placebos, but some people don't. And we don't really fully understand why that is. And we need to understand that to statistically account for it in trials, because otherwise we don't know, you know, how much of the effect is placebo in each group. Yeah. So I think that's where I'm going to focus my efforts. I think that's where I'm really interested. I'm interested in pain in general as well. I've been working on a few different trials around chronic pain and delivering explained pain educational type interventions and things like that. So I love participating and helping collect data and contributing to the design of those sorts of clinical trials as well.
Yeah. So I guess this is a nice tie into my next question. In your opinion, what should contemporary pain science education look like for the practitioners and then also the clients that we work with?
Yeah, that's a big question. Yeah, good one. I think first and foremost, it has to be based on good science, good up-to-date contemporary science, the most up-to-date that we have available to us. We have to stay on top of that. I think a really important thing as well is that it needs to be individualized, really relevant to the patient's current situation, the current understanding of their pain, their health literacy level, and current capacity to take on that information too. We don't want to overload our patients and give them too much information, because then they won't take any of the key messages on. So being really adaptable in the delivery of the messages. I think when I'm teaching my students at Flinders University who are in the physio program, I always say to them that the messages need to be clear. And I always quote Einstein, if you can't explain it simply, then you don't understand it well enough. And there's another quote I always say to them, which I don't know word for word, but to paraphrase Mick Thacker, if we're to accept the immense privilege of treating people with pain and helping them understand it and overcome it, then we have the utmost responsibility to know what it is that we're talking about. And if that takes some damn hard work, then so be it. So I think that's a really powerful, really powerful message, and something that we as clinicians really need to take on and really take seriously to help our patients with pain education. And I think one of the key things with pain education, based on my experience with clinical practice, I think one of the most pervasive messages out there about pain in our community is that pain is equal to tissue damage and is a direct marker of tissue damage. And so we need to break that belief, and because if we don't break that belief, then the best treatments and best prevention strategies make no sense to people. So, for example, movement-based therapies hurt for people in pain. So why would they do it? Why would they do something that makes them hurt more? And the key ingredient there is educating them about it. And so we need to do everything we can to make that information as clear and convincing as possible. Yeah.
I like it. I like it a lot. So last but not least, since you're doing some amazing work, where can people find out more about what you do? I'm assuming you got some social media, something that you use, and maybe also where can people find out more about the work of your research group?
Yeah. So I have a personal Twitter account that I use it mostly for work-related stuff. So that's F Braithwaite PT. For Twitter. Okay. The Body and Mind group also have a Twitter account. I think that would just be at Body and Mind. and they also have a great Facebook group and a great website, which you can just Google with an awesome blog, which they have blogs posting on there quite regularly. So that's a great way to keep up to date on the most contemporary pain science out there. And, you know, I have my work website as well, which is just via Flinders University, which isn't as exciting as my Twitter, but it will have my publications and things on there.
No, that's important too for people that actually want to dig into this stuff a little bit, right? Excellent. So yeah, I learned a lot just in talking to you, and I'm definitely gonna try and stay up to date. I think that's one of the things, or one of our responsibilities as practitioners, whether, you know, it's kind of first stage, you know, physios that kind of work on the frontier when it comes to rehabilitation, but then also second stage. So like S&C coaches that work with people that have been in pain or maybe try to come back from an injury. I believe there lies a large responsibility in trying to deliver the highest quality care that we can. And it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure from my end as well. And I look forward to listening back.
Awesome. Thanks.
All right.